Welcome to a special bonus edition of Solving JFK. Today I'll be joined by my co-authors on the JFK assassination chokeholds, James DiEugenio, Paul Blow, Andrew Eiler, and Mark Adamczyk. We're going to talk about the recent congressional hearing from the Committee to Declassify Government Secrets, led by Congresswoman Luna, as well as going over what we've covered on this season 3 of the podcast. Coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
All right, guys. Hey, the big news with JFK assassination chokeholds is that we now have a version in French that is due to our friend Paul Blow taking the lead on that. Paul, you want to let everybody know about the new book that's out in French?
Yes. It's chokeholds doesn't translate well in French, but the rest of our concept does. In other words, the content of the book is really, really attractive to the French Canadian market. There's an enthusiasm like I've rarely seen. We call it the irrefutable, because chokeholds kind of means that, right? And we couldn't translate chokeholds. It would have been some sort of wrestling term that just didn't mean anything. The success we've had, just to let you know, we were 310th this morning in Canada in the Amazon rankings. And that's high. I mean, I think the highest we've ever been, right, with the English version. So we're 10th. We were 10th in the province in 10th in French book sales in Canada. So 310th for all books, but 10th for French.
Sure. It's good to hear that it's been received so well so far in Quebec. And hopefully we'll get in some more places where they speak French. Well, hey, let's jump into one of the main reasons I wanted to have all you guys here today, which is to talk through the recent congressional hearings on the Declassification of Government Secrets Task Force. So this is the Rep Luna committee. And Jen, this is the same one that you, of course, testified in front of on April 1st. And I was creepily right there behind your shoulder with me on the right and Andrew on the left there. That was a fun time. Just wanted to get everybody's thoughts on this last round of testimony. So just to start out, Doug Horn, we all believe Mr. Horn is a true expert on the medical evidence. I thought he did a nice job of getting some important points from Destiny Betrayed on the record as well. So what were your thoughts on that? I guess starting with Jim.
I'm glad Doug showed up. Okay. And I thought that that was pretty provocative. If you hadn't read his book, that was some new stuff.
Had you heard of this Quentin Schwinn? That was the first time I'd ever heard this story. He told the story of a guy who had a job interview with a federal agency and said that he saw a high in the forehead entrance wound in 2010. He was interviewing for a job with an intelligence agency, and he said he was shown a color positive transparency of an entrance wound.
Yes, I had heard of him.
Forehead. I don't know if he was at.
I had heard of him. And in fact, in the Mantic Corsi book, okay, Final Analysis, okay, they actually spent a couple of pages on him, okay? And it's a very, very interesting story, okay? And I don't think Gunn and Horn actually talked about that at all. And this was something that was different and new, okay? And it's a very, very, in, But again, I don't know if it's true or not. It's one of these things that, is very compelling and very mysterious, but I don't know how you can confirm it. So yes, I did hear of this story, yes.
Because that's four people who say that they saw a small entrance wound in the right
Yeah,
hairline
right,
of the
correct.
president. So, other thoughts on Doug Horne's testimony?
What strikes me here is that you have another top level insider who doesn't agree that there's a known up. And just the power of that presence there. You're talking about one of the top investigators, well, investigators as far as the medical evidence for the ARB, telling the world, telling Congress, things that are now on the record and that will be archived forever. And it puts people like us on the right side of history. Who's going to call any of us five quacks when you have Dan Hardaway saying what he said, Tonheim saying what he said, and Doug Horne saying what he said, and Nunes saying, I don't believe in the single bullet theory. So that's what I loved about the hearings. And I think that's a big positive for us.
What I really took away, I think, is that for the first time on national TV, the country was told essentially that what many witnesses at Bethesda, at the Bethesda autopsy saw was exactly what the Parkland doctor saw. For 60 years, the American public has heard the official story, the officially incorrect story, is that the Parkland doctors were wrong. They didn't see a big hole in the back of the head. The chief of neurosurgery at Southwestern Medical School didn't know where the occiput was or didn't know what the cerebellum looked like. And for the first time on national TV, Doug Horne made it very clear that a majority of the Bethesda witnesses saw the same head wounds as were reported in at Parkland Hospital in Dallas. And that's a revelation for the American public, because I don't think that that's ever been discussed like it was by Doug Horne on national TV ever before. And I think Luna, Representative Luna, really grabbed hold of that. She's reposted Doug Horne's testimony in five or six separate tweets. And she clearly understood why this was very, very important testimony.
The bigger picture for me as a lawyer is since the ARB, we've had all these revelations. We've had Doug Horne's work. We've had, a lot more information out on Oswald and his 201 file. But this now is in the record of a congressional investigation. And that's what's groundbreaking about it. You have Hardaway talking about on the record Oswald being operational in Mexico City and in New Orleans. You have Horne saying exactly what Andrew just said. It's all in the record. So I'm fascinated to see where they go with it now.
Just to follow up on what Mark said too, where I think the members of Congress on the task force, really what they needed to hear is how all of this was suppressed at the HSCA, and that maybe I missed that part of the hearing, but I don't think anyone got into the real problem that happened during the late 70s when the Bethesda witnesses and all of their testimony was seriously suppressed by the HSCA. And that's a real problem. I mean, Andy Purdy is still alive. He should be called in
Right.
for on a subpoena.
At this point in the Zoom, we had some technical difficulties and we had to start over. I wish I would have heard Andrew's point about issuing subpoenas to people who were HSCA investigators, because I agree that that's something that could potentially be very helpful. Anyway, back to the show. Coe, this Alexis Coe. So she was sort of the, I guess, the Democrats' witness. And I guess this just sort of once again reinforced that apparently the Democratic Party is taking the position that there was no conspiracy and they're not interested in seeing it. I mean, that's it's really a bummer, because I feel like Garcia, The Democratic chair of the committee is open to some extent and seems like a reasonable guy, but for whatever reason, their witnesses are just I mean, yeah,
What was
I
she
don't know.
doing there?
Nobody knows. The way
You know, she's supposed to be writing a book on young JFK. What that would have to do with what was supposed to be the topic of that committee hearing, this utterly escapes me, except that the Democratic Party is so lost and so frightened and so intimidated that they don't even want to face the fact that, in my opinion, the last great Democratic president was snuffed out, okay, by illegal means, by a conspiracy. They don't want to come to grips with that somehow, you
Or
know?
they're just being used as tools because both of their witnesses were foils to what the committee was actually looking for. It's shameful.
It
And
is.
their questions were shameful.
The questions are horrible. I mean, they're still the fact that they're not prepared on the basic facts of the case, it blows my mind. You can tell who's prepared. Like Burchett, Andrew, he's great. The others are
Yeah.
just like they're like kindergartners in there.
I don't think we should categorize it that way because I have to give Luna a lot of credit for what she's trying to do. Now, whatever her motivation is, whatever reasons for it, I don't know, okay? But there have never been hearings like this that have been broadcast to the country for now 6 straight hours. I've never seen anything like this. Okay, the closest thing that I can even imagine, you know, happening was when Cyril Wett gave his 25-minute dissertation against the single bullet theory before the House Select Committee. But that was only on one subject for 25 minutes. You know, you have what is essentially you had an all-star lineup, okay, in these two hearings, you know, which, you know, and so I give her all the credit in the world for doing this. Now, I really do wish, as Mark said, that some of her colleagues would have come more pre. And by the way, did you notice this? Garcia was the only Democrat there.
Yes. Yeah, you
That
know, Jim,
was.
I just want to clarify. When I say shameful, I am talking about the Democratic
Oh,
side
okay, good,
of the
good.
of yeah,
Well, me
of
too. I want to
the task
clarify
force.
too. I
Yeah.
think Luna's doing an amazing, brave
Yes.
job. Garcia's been fine. My point was some of the questions. I think they asked Dr. Curtis. He's the Parkland doctor, right?
Yes.
I think they asked him like three times in
Yes.
three different ways. Like, what did you see that made you disagree with the fact that Oswald may have acted alone? I'm like, how is that even a question? Like, just he got on the record at least the evidence of two. He said two shots from the front, but he was very clear on that. But the questions have wasted a lot of time, yeah.
But and by the way, let me add something about that. I take a back seat to nobody in my research and study of this case for the last 32 years. I didn't know who the guy was. I had never heard of him before. Okay, let alone that he would bring in this bombshell testimony. Okay, I guess his coming out party, according to Larry, was in 2018. That's the first time he ever talked in front of a crowd. And I wasn't there at that particular conference. But I mean, this guy, that was some really terrific testimony. I mean, you know, if Kemp Clark is not allowed, not around today, but this guy, more or less, you know, essentially is him, okay? You know, in, you know, as close as we can get. And in my opinion, Kemp Clark, well, he was the chief of neurosurgery. How could he be wrong? How could he be wrong about what he saw,
Right.
you know?
Getting back, Matt, to Luna, I am impressed. Okay, I really like the way she's handling it. She has poise, she has class, she's got a very good, I think, relationship with the witnesses. If I have one worry, and I was worried about this, thank God, Jim, you were at the first hearings because there's a knowledge gap between the people asking the questions and the real experts. There's a big knowledge gap. And who's going to bridge the gap? That was my question. And when I was looking at the bridging of the gap, okay, you don't have a Posner there. You don't have a Bugliosi there, thank God. But for a while, I felt they were getting, you know, sort of sidetracked into this whole, you know, this whole Angleton file, and that he lied and this and that. And I felt that they were, not that it's not important, but that they were farther, a little bit getting away from the meat of the subject in terms of how the conspiracy went. And I don't feel that if you're going to solve this, that you necessarily start with Angleton, who was in counterintelligence, right? I think that you have to go closer to Miami, Jamwave, and some people like Harvey and Phillips. So when I was looking at that, and you know, the amount of time being spent on Joannides and Angleton, which is again important, but it doesn't bring you to the heart of the conspiracy. You know, Angleton's an easy guy to throw under the bus because he got kicked out for his eavesdropping on Americans. So he's already a villain, you know. So it would be too bad that they shove all the blame in that area. And, you know, so I my worry is, who is the person or the persons that will bring Luna, you know, to the heart of the matter? I hope this goes on, is that it becomes something that's a little bit more democratic and a little bit more widespread in terms of input than, you know, a few people. So that's...
Well, you know, I actually thought that... having the panel that they had, I thought that was an interesting array of people that they got. Okay, I and I'll tell you this: everybody here heard Thunheim say what he said. He said that he's never seen some of these documents before. Okay, he was on the ARB for 4 years. He was the chairman of the committee, and he says, I've never seen some of these documents. Okay. I really wish somebody would have followed up on that. Okay. You know, I really
Jim,
wish.
Jim, I can tell you this, Jim. I found a document. I'm sure I'm not the first to come across this document. It was a CIA secret memo. I think it's 23 pages long. And it basically strategized on the part of the CIA how they were going to circumvent the JFK Records Act. And it was drafted in February of 1992, so 8 months before the act was passed. I've posted a tweet on it. It's actually quite unbelievable. They are literally strategizing how to circumvent the JFK Records Act. And what they did is they gathered up all of the CIA's HSCA records, which was almost the totality of the records, and they transferred them to the National Archives under their current classification. And what that allowed to happen was that those documents were not given RIF numbers, they were not given identification aids, and they were not reviewed by the Assassination Records Review Board. And the archivist was given complete discretion whether they would be published or whether they would be given RIF numbers. So the big, big question is, and this kind of goes into what Matt wants to get into later, where are those documents? How many of them were reviewed? How many of them are still being held secret? Because I think John Avery Emison, who contacted you, Jim,
yes,
he is being in touch with the National Archives.
Right.
And they said, well, a whole bunch of HSCA records are still being kept and withheld until 2029. So there's the catalog is an absolute disaster, and we don't know how many documents are still secret from the HSCA.
This sounds to me like NARA is almost an accomplice with the CIA.
There are some documents that have come out. They've been independently vouched for as being legitimate. But the reason they're said to not be real is because there's no RIF number. So in theory, there could be legit documents don't have RIF numbers, is what you're saying.
Oh, 100%.
Yes.
No, it's section 5D3 of the act. You just need to pull up section 5D3. It's actually incredible. It was like there was a carve out that was either kind of shoved in there for the benefit of the CIA, or they just gamed it out completely. And there probably are thousands of documents, tens of thousands. I do have to give Joe Bax credit. He identified this back in 1998 in a letter that he sent to the ARRB and said, hey, what about all of these records that were handed over to NARA before the act was passed?
One more thing I want to cover on the congressional hearings. Hardway, he laid out the CIA was using Oswald operationally in Mexico City, and that Oswald was dangled in Mexico City, just like he was discrediting the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans. And Hardaway actually said both of those things. And I remember seeing the document where the CIA said, hey, we're going to start discrediting the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in foreign countries. And then like a week later, Oswald supposedly is in Mexico City. So I thought that was big for Hardaway to bring that up. You know, it supported everything else. And then on the Tunheim side of things, he said that the CIA knew about Oswald in advance and did not tell the ARRB. I thought that was big from him. Then he said the CIA has deliberately misled. So, you know, the question becomes, and Tunheim is not going to say more than he thinks he has, certainly. I understand he's, you know, seems to be playing it safe to an extent. I don't mean to, yeah, to denigrate Judge Tunheim in any way, but I'm saying he's not going to jump out on a limb by any means. But what he said is a big deal. Why would the CIA do what he is saying they did if they had nothing to hide?
Judge Tunheim is the furthest thing from a conspiracy theorist, right? And I've listened to almost every public statement that he's made, and this is by far the strongest statement that he has made in public that I'm aware of. Jim probably knows even better than I do about how firm he has been. But yeah, he came right out and said the CIA misled. They did not provide the full story. I think he made comments about the Joannides files particularly, but he was pretty hard hitting. Based on what I've seen over the last 30 years.
I agree. I've never seen him as forceful, okay, as he was during that hearing. He's usually a very conservative guy, okay? But he was pretty strong in his condemnation of how the CIA had either dodged or avoided what their obligations were.
Two statements mapped out to Hardway. He also said that at least on one of the phone calls, Oswald, he said imitated, but later said was impersonated. Okay, so, you know, that, think of that. Think of that. And remember the look on the face of the congressman.
Yeah.
Who, he said, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, what's this lone nut doing being impersonated in Mexico City? Like, you can tell that they're having trouble wrapping their brains around this thing. And I want you guys to let me know if I got it wrong. Didn't Curtis say that the medical staff at Parkland received a briefing that described the cause of death being a shot through the temple causing an exit wound in the back of the head? I'm 90% sure I heard that. Did you pick up on that, or am I, might be worth re-listening to, but I thought I heard him say that it was a briefing.
Yeah, that's what I thought he said.
Yeah. So, you know, like, wow. you're saying that there's a briefing given to, here's how he died. And then it kind of chimes with Kilduff saying it's a simple matter, right, of a bullet right through the head. And he's pointing right here, right? So it makes sense.
Right.
After that hearing, this was my impression, that if there was one guy who should actually come in for a deposition, you know, with no holds barred, it's Dan Hardway. Okay. Dan Hardway should sit for about a 2-hour deposition, you know, with the staff of Luna's committee. Okay, and they should ask for preparation questions, you know, about Mexico City. You know, I've always believed this. I've always believed that The key to the conspiracy was Mexico City. Okay, 7 weeks in advance of the assassination. Was Oswald there? Okay, and I think the Lopez report, which the CIA never wanted revealed, okay, I think provides some strong prima facie evidence that if Oswald was in Mexico City, he sure as heck didn't do the things that the Warren Commission said he did. Okay, so that leaves us in a quandary. All right, who was doing those phone calls? Who was impersonating Oswald? Okay, and you can't even begin to wrap your head around the why, unless you find out for sure, okay, what really happened there. And and Dan Hardway knows more about that than anybody else. Okay, well, hold it. Let me make one exception. Eddie Lopez. Maybe that should be a joint deposition. Him and Eddie Lopez. I'll never forget the first time I read the Lopez report. I was going to go up to see Eddie at his house in Rochester, New York, and I wrote a list of questions for him. And one of the questions was, because I had never seen her name before, one of the questions was, who is Ann Goodpasture? And when I asked that question, I'll never forget how Eddie replied to this. Okay, Annie Goodpasture, she's a lying, conniving bitch. And if there was any justice in this world, she'd be in jail. And I said, but Eddie, who was she? Okay, who was she?
Hey everybody, Matt Crumpton here. When I'm not researching, writing, or recording, one of my favorite ways to relax is with federally legal THC from Mood.com. This stuff doesn't come from a lab. It's pesticide-free and grown on American farms. You can get 20% off your first order using the code JFK. One of my go-tos is the functional gummies from Mood.com. These gummies only take 15 minutes to feel the effects, and you can choose all kinds of different moods, from creativity to pain relief to just plain old relaxation. Everything comes right to your door and is discreetly labeled. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you also get 20% off of your first order using code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Remember, use code JFK for a 20% discount.
Just to add to what Jim was saying, Dan Hardway had given a sworn statement in support of Jeff Morley's lawsuit against the CIA. I think it was about 10 years ago. And I was disappointed he didn't get more on the record about his questioning of Phillips. And I'm not sure why Phillips is getting more of a pass than what he's getting. Because we got to remember that the purpose of the committee is to, make sure all the records are released and get all the information out there. It's not to reinvestigate the case, but if, like Jim said, if they question Dan Hardway more about his questioning of Phillips, because I don't think it's really on paper, but we know that Phillips was Joe Eniti's essential boss, and that would tie the dots from Mexico City possibly more onto Dallas. And I think that would be, those questions would be worth exploring. They said, Hardway said in that statement that I mentioned that the CIA got crazy, the most nervous when they talked to Phillips and when they went into Harvey. So.
Now, I don't know if you guys know this, but Danny and Eddie wrote up bills of indictment against Phillips and Goodpasture for perjury. Okay. During the House Select Committee on Assassination. That would have been a great question for Luna to ask. Did you write up a letter of indictment for any people that you interviewed? And he would have said, yes, David Phillips and Ann Goodpasture. Okay, because they wouldn't tell us the truth about what was going on down there. But to give you just one example, to make this definite instead of speculative, when they asked Goodpasture who had the first take of the photographic and audio of the embassies, And she referred them to like some guy that they had never heard of. And so they went and talked to this guy. And they said, no. And he said, no, you might want to talk to this guy. So they went to another guy. And then that guy said, no, it wasn't me. And they went to another guy. And he said, no, you might want to talk to Mr. White. He could probably tell you. And you know what White said? It was Ann Goodpasture. Ann Goodpasture had the first take of the audio and photographic evidence. So that's one of the reasons that they wrote up these bills of indictment. You know, she was deliberately deceiving them.
No, that was really, I think, incredibly interesting. You know, the whole, the fact that you had Hardaway saying that on the record, right? And Tunheim and Horn, again, to me, is historical. Because,
yes.
Because to me, the weight of their voices, and no disrespect, Jim, or anything, but if I'm, Joe Public, and I'm hearing an investigator saying something rather than, you know, I don't want to, you know, a so-called expert or a book writer or whatnot, that should carry an awful lot of weight. And it really puts us on the side, I think, of the majority of insiders. They're not the only one. So, you know, I think that is huge.
My question real quick, just before we go on to one to a, sort of a different set of things.
Do you guys think it would be helpful to consider
bringing in some of the real, real huge witnesses in the case, like Ruth Payne, Marina Oswald, Buell Wesley Frazier? And if, I mean, are they too old? Would it not matter? Part of me says, well, if we're going to bring in Abraham Bolden, then age is not, does not matter. And then the question really is, you know, we know what Ruth Payne's going to say. It'd be real interesting to hear from Marina. I feel like Frazier would be all over the place, but what do you guys think?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think, like I get back to what I just said, the purpose of the committee is to get all the records out and all the information out. I agree with Matt. We know what they're going to say. I'd rather see a full-blown investigation into Mexico City, JM Wave, and the autopsy. Who knew that JFK was killed from the front, from frontal shots, by the time he got to Bethesda? Who knew to cover that up and why? That's what I'd like to see.
I think everybody knows what Ruth Payne's going to say. Okay. I mean, if there's anybody who's going to be a predictable witness, you know, the only way that I would have Ruth Payne on this stand is if Max Good was allowed to cross-examine her. Okay. That's the guy who made the documentary about the Paynes. Okay. And I don't think they're going to do that. I don't think she would agree to that kind of thing. Marina Oswald, oh my God, she's been around for so long and said so many contradictory things, you know, and I think the same thing about Wesley Frazier. You know, the important thing about Wesley Frazier is what he went through at the hands of the Dallas police, all right, and how far they were willing to go to try and intimidate him, all right. You know, and again, if there was going to be an examination of Wesley Frazier, it would have to be from both sides of the equation. Okay, you know, like, okay, here's what he said that I think is accurate. Here's what he said. And I don't think they're gonna go along with that kind of thing. To be perfectly honest, I'm really glad they did what they did so far. Okay. And to get back to what Paul was talking about, I think he was saying that the stress was too much on the chief of counterintelligence. Well, I think that's because Jefferson Morley, from what I know, is the main outside advisor that Luna has. Okay. And we know that that's his bailiwick. That's what he likes to concentrate on. Okay. So I think that is why, you know, if there's a too heavy concentration on that, I think it's because Jeff is, but I give Jeff a lot of credit for getting that panel together, which I'm pretty sure he had some input in that. Okay. Which I think was a pretty good panel.
My deep concern, and just going to follow up on what Jim has said, I think it's pretty standard operating procedure when there's going to be a shift in the truth, is that the CIA's modus operandi is to do a limited hangout and really try to limit the damage that's done by new documents coming out and new evidence coming out. And my worry is that the fixation on Joannides and Angleton is going to end up being part of a limited hangout. And I think that would be pretty disappointing if that was the extent of it, because, you know, Angleton was counterintelligence. He wasn't operations. Joannides was psychological warfare. And they both had important roles in the big story, but there are many parts to that story that I think need to be heard fully by the public and need to be examined fully by the task force. And again, if this is an exercise that's going to end up in a limited hangout, I think that's going to be problematic.
In terms of people I'd like to see them talk to, it would be interesting to hear Carlos Bringier being asked questions about who his DRE contacts, you know, like, you know, who did you interface with, and get to the bottom of, hey, you know, this fight you had with Oswald, was that a setup? Was not, you know, he may not answer.
Yeah. You know, on these hearings, the committee's been extended for another 6 months. So looks like there may be another round of hearings. We'll see what ends up happening. What I'd like to see is, you know, and I don't know if anybody else on the critical research side shares my view of this, but I think you do a 3-day conference, a super conference, and all of it gets put into the congressional record. Okay. And day one is just lone nutters and, you know, critical side, conspiracy side, battling it out. Day one is just the lone nut conspiracy battle. And then day two and day three is putting on evidence of, okay, we've already had the conversation about was it a conspiracy or not. Now we're putting on evidence in terms of what it was, who the conspirators were. And, you know, we can put all the evidence in there. And then, you know, people can look at that and decide. Maybe there's a report that's issued based on the evidence. But I don't know if that's going to happen. I don't know what will happen, but something's better than nothing, most likely. I suppose there are ways where something could be worse than nothing.
Well, if they got a 6-month renewal, that'd be very interesting to see, because if they did, it's off the success of these two hearings. Okay, so the Republican leadership, yeah, must have some confidence in what Luna's doing so far. Okay, and then that's really good. Now, they're next on the agenda that I saw. They're going to do the King case, and they're going to do the RFK case also. So again, that would be very, very interesting. And I don't think any committee has ever done that before. The House Select Committee just did JFK and MLK. No committee has ever explored all three of those cases put together, you know. So to try and boost, I've been doing a series on King, all right, and I'm going to ask my followers on Substack to go ahead and email the Luna Committee and ask them to do the same thing with King and RFK that they did with JFK, to have a panel of experts, okay, to address the public on this, to educate them in some ways. All right, so that should be very, very interesting. I'm glad she got that extension.
If the end game here of what Luna's doing, could it be something along the lines of, hey, listen, we've released this amount of what we knew was still, but we're still missing this and that. Okay, so, you know, and you know that they put pressure on getting whatever should be added, for instance, the Joannides file or whatever, okay? Could the second conclusion be, based on these hearings, we recommend that the case be reopened? And that's when you would hear a Ruth Payne and a Bringier, and is that where this could be headed? Or, you know, like, I'm not sure this is yet the forum to be trying to necessarily figure out what the conspiracy was. Is it, would that be a phase two, is my question.
The conversations I had there in terms of what's going to happen next really are controlled by the politics of the day, right? So this the Republicans control that the committee, and they think this is making them look good, so they're going to keep doing it. It is making them look good because the Democrats are reflexively putting their fingers in their ears and going la 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 la. So it does make Republicans look sane on this particular issue. Now the question is, how much of the energy going towards JFK from the committee can continue to go towards JFK when there are so many other points, as Jim laid out, that the committee also has to cover? So yeah, we'll see. And then and the reality is, like, there are some good folks on this committee, you know, Burchett in particular. Nancy Mace has come prepared a couple of times with questions, but and Luna, of course. But really, if you look at Congress at large, at Republicans, you know, Republicans are not like in a hurry to go fight the military industrial complex either. They just, it's like, it's good for their base. Their base goes, yeah, there were all these conspiracies, and, you know, they're maybe they're right. Okay. But at the same time, you know, moderates and Republicans in the Senate, they don't want any part of this. So it's got a ceiling, which is dictated by modern American politics, is my view. But we'll see where it goes. Okay, hey, thanks again, guys, for being generous with your time today. Sorry with some of these technical difficulties. I wanted to just kind of get your thoughts on where I am in my podcast, Solving JFK, and kind of, you know, get your thoughts, I guess, on some things I'm doing this season. Quickly before we leave here, just kind of walk you guys through my findings so far in season three and kind of get your quick thoughts. So in season three, so just as a reminder, season one is sort of like the main evidence, right? Season two is just looking at Oswald's biography. Who's Oswald? Birth to death. What's he doing everywhere? What do all the files say? Season three is, if not Oswald, then who? That's the hard part. I'm going through all the potential culprits, all the people everybody says it could be, right? So I start with the Secret Service. Did six episodes, had Vince Palomara on, and long, bottom line, and this is, as you guys all know, Secret Service had about 10 to 12 different types of security stripping that happened. There's not one particular, not necessarily one thing you can point to. It's the combination of all of these things all together that were unique to Dallas, where they actually knew that there were, that Dallas was more of a threat on that Texas trip, as the documents show. But, you know, the question is, okay, so why did they do that? And it looks like it had to be either this guy, Floyd Boring, the guy that did all of the bad stuff, like the guy who is where the rubber meets the road at almost every one of these horrible choices, is a guy named Winston Lawson. So it's like the same guy, and it's either Lawson or Floyd. And you know, but the question is, why was someone talking to them? I don't know. So that's kind of where we left Secret Service. Like, yeah, we know that it's Boring or Lawson that's doing the stuff. Maybe Emery Roberts is another guy that Palomara said, but we don't know. It's a black hole as to why they made all these choices. But it's not believable that these were all coincidences. That's kind of what I landed on vis-a-vis Secret Service. Anybody have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've always thought Winston Lawson was a very suspicious character. And I know that Vince likes to downplay him for whatever reasons, I don't know. But if you really read the testimony, it was Lawson who picked that route, okay? And the Warren Commission tried to cover this up by saying that was the only route that was a lie, okay? That was not the only route if you wanted to get to the trademark. And it's right in the House Select Committee volumes. They looked this up, you know, and I think it's in volume 11, where they say, no, anybody resorting to a street map of Dallas in 1963, we'll see that there were other ways that you could get to the trademark. Okay, so this has always been something that I was very curious about. People forget that next to the FBI, the Secret Service did the most investigating of the assassination. So as bad as the FBI it was, and they were pretty horrible, okay, you can't let the Secret Service say they were any less horrible. Okay, because they were pretty bad. So Winston Lawson has always been up there for me as being, you know, when you go down to Dallas, which I've done several times, and you look out over that trestle and you see this, and you, how could anybody have recommended that route, okay, to conduct, especially somebody in the Secret Service? Because, you know, if you look out, you look, if you were planning an assassination, you could not have thought up a better place to do it and a better route to take, you know? So this is why Winston Lawson has always been an interesting character to me.
The other name that's interesting, maybe on a higher up point, is Paul Paterni. Paul Paterni is interesting because he became the liaison between the Secret Service and the Warren Commission. And he's buddy-buddy with Angleton. And who's the guy for the FBI? Is it Rocha? Not Rocha. The name I'm forgetting, but Paterni, Angleton, and this FBI guy were thick as thieves in the OSS, okay? And they happened to become the liaisons. Now, what do you have is you have a Raleigh to Paterni who's friends with Angleton. You have a Dulles to Angleton who's friends with the other two. And you had the perfect liaison for the FBI also. So in terms of controlling the cover-up, Paterni was really interesting. The other little thing that came out, Jim, in Paul Abbott's book is one of the Dallas cops who made a strange phone call in a coffee shop, you know, just before the transfer of Oswald and just before Ruby made it in, was a guy calling Paul Paterni. And that, when Paul Abbott put it in there, I don't think he knew the significance of that thing. So I said, Paul, do you know who Paul Paterni is? And I said, read what Vince Palomares say about Paul Paterni. So Paterni doesn't have as many links because he's not in Dallas or anything like that. But as a higher up person who's part of the coordinating, you know, he'd be someone I'd have my eyes on.
I want to move on to the next thing because I know we're kind of going long here. The next culprit I covered is
Hoover and the FBI.
And that's the one that I just finished up. And where I landed on that was really looking at three questions. Was Hoover a plotter in the assassination of JFK? I found the answer to be no. Okay. There's just no evidence that I could find in support of him actually being part of any plot. The second one was, did Hoover have foreknowledge of the assassination? I found that to be inconclusive. And the arguments in favor of foreknowledge are there were a couple of like mafia hits that he became aware of that he did not pass on to the Secret Service or RFK. But you can also argue that those were perhaps not detailed enough. Like it was going to be in the South before 1964, like, you know, that's not incredibly actionable. But so you could argue that. And of course, Hoover went to the Del Charro Hotel every year for 2 weeks, and he's hanging out with basically with all the mafia and Texas oil guys. So who knows what happened there? So that's why I found that inconclusive. And then my third question was Hoover involved in a cover-up of the assassination? And I found that to be yes, he was. And what I leaned on for evidence is the phone call the day after the assassination, obviously Rex Bradford's great work on the missing 14-minute tape, but we have the transcript, which we don't know, is it a full transcript or is it the partial transcript, where Hoover talks about, you know, Oswald was impersonated in Mexico City. But then they never talk about it again after that. So Hoover brings up this big thing, and of course we know that he thinks the CIA is behind it from his marginalia, where he says, you know, the CIA and their obvious, you know, double dealing when it came to the false story, R.E. Oswald in Mexico City. That's like he wrote that in the margins of a document. So he knows that CIA is involved. He knows there's an imposter, but it's never discussed again. It's never brought up again, and it's never put to bed. And he just assumed what changed everything wasn't some smoking gun thing being discovered in the case. It was Ruby killing Oswald. That seems to be what changed everything. Then there's a phone call between LBJ, Hoover, Katzenbach. They all get on the phone. you know, Rostow and all these sort of establishment people are trying to get the commission going, et cetera. There's all these phone calls going everywhere. And then the Katzenbach memo comes out. And then Hoover, you know, he goes from saying the case is not very, very strong Saturday to, hey, we've got our man, let's wrap it up, and the Katzenbach memo. So I think without a doubt, Hoover's involved in and leading the cover-up would be my position. What about you guys?
Yeah, if you even in the Warren report, it says that the leading investigatory arm for the Warren Commission was the FBI. I think something like 80% of all the reports that came in were from the FBI. And I don't think there's any debate today about whether or not the FBI was involved in the cover-up of the Kennedy assassination. It's so obvious that I don't even think it needs to be talked about anymore. Now, whether or not Hoover had ample warning or clear warning, I think that's something that's up in the air. I don't think you can conclude anything on that question. I think you can argue both ways of that question. Your first question about whether he was in on the assassination, I would tend to agree what you said. There isn't any real evidence that he was. I mean, the very fact that he didn't know until 6 weeks later that the CIA had given him a snow job on Mexico City, you know, I think that's kind of exculpatory, you know, for J. Edgar Hoover. And then there's that meeting he has with Billy Byers, okay, down in, I don't know where that was, La Jolla, okay, that he had that dinner with, okay, and Billy Byers asked him, well, what do you think really happened? Okay, and I think this was about 6 months after the assassination, and Hoover said, I can't tell you because it would be a very danger to security of this country. Okay, that's always one of my favorite comments about the Kennedy assassination from a person in a high office.
I never heard that.
Oh, it's terrific. A terrific quote. It's in my book, The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Matt. Maybe he knew something was in the air, you know, like, you know, the rumors and everything. I don't think he knew the plans in Dallas, you know, or the plot that finally took him up. I don't get that feeling. Cover up for sure, for sure. I mean, you can read breach of trust. You read the HSCA conclusions about how the FBI or the Church Committee, how the FBI performed its functions, and you see that it's a mess, right? They do no similar case analysis. Their ballistics, you know, they tend to pick and choose and cherry pick what they want to cherry pick and present. The witnesses they choose not to ask questions to and everything. So you look at it. There's no doubt that there's a cover up. There's no doubt that orders were given within a week to earlier even to say we're going the lone nut route. So the second you have an agenda, well, you're going to make the investigation engineer it in a way that it concludes what your agenda will take you to. So if the order is yeah. We're going the lone nut route, well, you know, make the evidence work. That's the way I see it.
Andrew and Mark, you guys have thoughts on this?
I tend to like to stay in my lane. I've got a pretty narrow lane. But I do, I have a feeling that Johnson and Hoover hijacked the CIA's plan. The CIA was all over Mexico City. Very quickly, within hours, Hoover and Johnson had a strong feeling that it was a CIA military plot. They didn't want to lose hold of the government, and they quickly hijacked it and turned it into a lone nut scenario. And that's why you saw Katzenbach's memo come out. And Mexico City really was part of the CIA plot, not the lone nut plot. So that just had to kind of fizzle out and disappear. And that's why there's really no explanation about Mexico City. It's my feeling, but that's way out of my lane.
a couple of things, you know, Oswald surviving November 22nd to begin with, which could not have been the plan. I mean, if it was a Northwoods type operation of sorts to blame Cuba immediately, that just died when Oswald did not die right away. Then Ruby takes care of it. That raised another, of course, major alarm bell. And I think Hoover and Johnson, like Andrew said, I think quit, especially like Jim said, the snow job from the CIA, Mexico City. They knew a full investigation into Oswald and his background would lead to right back to an intelligence operation, and they decided it was in the best interest to go the lone nut route. I mean, that's how I see it.
Right on. Well, hey guys, I appreciate your time today, and yeah, I'm going to be getting into to all these things.
Matt, are you going to do a commercial for the book before we leave?
Yes, I've heard that.
point above your right shoulder.
If you speak French, hey.
Now available in French.
All right, that's what I wanted to see.
Yeah,
okay, that's what I wanted to see.
Good work, Paul.
Irrefutable.
Right. Yeah, thanks, Matt, for having us on your show. Look, I think the five of us, and now we can throw in Mark Bernard for the French. I honestly am proud of the work we've all done together. You know, to me, it stood the test of time. I've looked at the critiques of the book, and to me, it's very frivolous. You know, some of the things there might be one thing or two, but the book is holding up really well after a year and a half. And I think we did our job, guys, by relying on primary evidence. Okay? Our we went to documents and we were careful. And I'd like to thank the attorneys because you guys also brought in, you know, you complimented. First of all, you're very knowledgeable too in terms of the case. But, you know, you removed the frivolous from any, you know, like we don't have the backyard photos in there, and I don't believe the backyard photos are genuine, but they're not in there because they didn't reach the level we wanted. And I think it's, and when I talk about that to the French market, they say, oh yeah, it's, you're telling me it's all supported. And yes, it is. And there's a reason you're not hearing too many people really putting up criticism about this book that sticks. It doesn't.
Thanks again, and appreciate you guys coming on, and I'm sure we'll be able to put together some of it that'll make sense given even the technical difficulty that we had. We'll be back with Solving JFK for our first episode on Lyndon Johnson next week. Thanks a lot.